shaking her head and clicking the mouse.
"You going to be much longer?" asked Carol. "You know, there's a whole computer unit that's meant to be doing that, not you."
Daisy made a noise. It was not a yes noise, and it was not a no noise. It was an "I know somebody just said something to me, and if I make a noise, maybe they'll go away" sort of noise. Carol had heard that noise before.
"Oi," she said. "Big bum, are you going to be much longer? I wanted to be blog."
Daisy processed the words. Two of them sank in.
"Are you saying I've got a big bum?"
"No," said Carol. "I'm saying that it's getting late, and I want to do me blog. I'm going to have him shagging a supermodel in the loo of an unidentified London night spot."
Daisy sighed.
"All right," she said. "It's just fishy, that's all."
"What's fishy?"
"Embezzlement, I think."
"Right, I've logged out. It's all yours. You know, you can get into trouble for impersonating a member of the royal family."
"Bog off."
Carol blogged as a member of the British royal family, young male and out of control. There had been arguments in the press about whether or not she was the real thing, many of them pointing to things that she wrote that could only have been known to an actual member of the British royal family or to someone who read the glossy gossip magazines. Daisy got up from the computer, still pondering the financial affairs of the Graham Coates agency. While fast asleep in his bedroom, in a large but certainly not ostentatious house in Purley, Graham Coates slept. If there was any justice in the world, he would have moaned and sweated in his sleep, tortured by nightmares, the furies of his conscience lashing him with scorpions. Thus, it pains me to admit that Graham Coates slept like a well-fed, milk-scented baby, and he dreamed of nothing at all. Somewhere in Graham Coates's house, a grandfather clock chimed politely 12 times. In London, it was midnight. In Florida, it was 7 in the evening. Either way, it was the witching hour. Mrs. Dunwoody removed the plasticated red and white check tablecloth and put it away. She said,
"Who's got the black candles?"
Miss Knoll said,
"I got the candles."
She had a shopping bag at her feet and she rummaged about in it, producing 4 candles. They were mostly black. One of them was tall and undecorated. The other 3 were in the shape of a cartoon black and yellow penguin with the wick coming out of his head.
"It was all they got,"
she said apologetically,
"and I had to go to 3 stores until I found anything."
Mrs. Dunwoody said nothing, but she shook her head. She arranged the 4 candles at the 4 ends of the table, taking the single non-penguin at the head of the table where she sat. Each of the candles sat on a plastic picnic plate. Mrs. Dunwoody took a large box of kosher salt, and she opened the spout and poured salt crystals on the table in a pile. Then she glared at the salt and pushed at it with a withered forefinger, prodding it into heaps and walls. Miss Knowles came back from the kitchen with a large glass bowl, which she placed at the centre of the table. She unscrewed the top from a bottle of sherry and poured a generous helping of sherry into the bowl.
"Now," said Mrs. Dunwoody, "the devil grass, the St. John the Conqueror root, and the love lies bleeding."
Mrs. Bustamante rummaged in her shopping bag once more and took out a small glass jar.
"It's mixed herbs,"
she explained.
"I thought it would be all right."
"Mixed herbs?"
said Mrs. Dunwoody.
"Mixed herbs?"
"Will that be a problem?"
said Mrs. Bustamante.
"It's what I always use when the recipe says basil this or oregano or that. I can't be doing with it. You ask me, it's all mixed herbs."
Mrs. Dunwoody sighed.
"Pour it in,"
she said. Half a bottle of mixed herbs was poured into the sherry. The dried leaves floated on the top of the liquid.
"Now,"
said Mrs. Dunwoody,
"the 4 earths. I hope," she said, choosing her words with care, "that no one here going to tell me that they could not get the 4 earths. And now we have to make do with a pebble, a dead jellyfish, a refrigerator magnet, and a bar of soap."
"I got the earths,"
said Mrs. Higgler. She produced the brown paper bag and pulled from it 4 Ziploc bags, each containing what looked like sand or dried clay, each of a different color. She emptied each bag at one of the 4 corners of the table.
"Glad somebody's paying attention,"
said Mrs. Dunwoody. Miss Knowles lit the candles, pointing out as she did so how easily the penguins lit and how cute and funny they were. Mrs. Bustamante poured out a glass of leftover sherry for each of the 4 women.
"Don't I get a glass?" asked Fat Charlie, but he didn't really want one. He didn't like sherry.
"No,"
said Mrs. Dunwoody firmly,
"you don't. You'll need your wits about you."
She reached into her purse and took out a small, golden-coloured pill case. Mrs. Higgler turned off the lights.
The five of them sat around the table in the candlelight. "Now what?" asked Fat Charlie. "Shall we all join hands and contact the living?"
"We do not," whispered Mrs. Dunwoody. "And I do not want to hear another word out of you."
"Sorry," said Fat Charlie, then wished he hadn't said it.
"Listen,"
said Mrs. Dunwoody.
"You will go where they may help you. Even so, give away nothing you own, and make no promises. You understand? If you have to give somebody something, then make sure you get something of equal value in return. Yes?"
Fat Charlie nearly said yes, but he caught himself in time and simply nodded.
"It is good."
And with that, Mrs. Dunwoody began to hum tunelessly in her old voice, which quavered and faltered. Miss Knowles also began to hum, rather more melodically. Her voice was higher and stronger. Mrs. Bustamante did not hum. She hissed instead, an intermittent snake-like hissing which seemed to find the rhythm of the humming and weave through it and beneath it. Mrs. Higgler started up, and she did not hum, and she did not hiss. She buzzed, like a fly against a window, making a vibrating noise with her tongue and her teeth, as odd and as unlikely as if she had a handful of angry bees in her mouth, buzzing against her teeth, trying to get out. Fat Charlie wondered if he should join in, but he had no idea what sort of thing he ought to do if he did, so he concentrated on sitting there and trying not to be weirded out by all the noises. Mrs. Higgler threw a pinch of red earth into the bowl of sherry and mixed herbs. Mrs. Bustamante threw in a pinch of the yellow earth. Miss Knowles threw in the brown earth, while Mrs. Dunwoody leaned over, painstakingly slowly, and dropped in a lump of black mud. Mrs. Dunwoody took a sip of her sherry. Then, with arthritic fingers fumbling and pushing, she took something from the pill case, and she dropped it into the candle flame. For a moment the room smelled of lemons, and then it simply smelled as if something was burning. Miss Knowles began to drum on the tabletop. She did not stop humming. The candle flames flickered, dancing huge shadows across the walls. Mrs. Higgler began to tap on the tabletop as well, her fingers knocking out a different beat to Miss Knowles, faster, more percussive, the two drum beats twining to form a new rhythm. In Fat Charlie's mind, all the sounds began to blend into one strange sound, the humming and the hissing and the buzzing and the drums. He was starting to feel light-headed. Everything was funny. Everything was unlikely. In the noises of the women he could hear the sound of wildlife in the forest, hear the crackling of enormous fires. His fingers felt stretched and rubbery. His feet were an immensely long way away. It seemed then that he was somewhere above them, somewhere above everything, and that beneath him there were five people around a table. Then one of the women at the table gestured and dropped something into the bowl in the middle of the table, and it flared up so brightly that Fat Charlie was momentarily blinded. He shut his eyes, which he found out did no good at all. Even with his eyes closed, everything was much too bright for comfort. He rubbed his eyes against the daylight. He looked around. A sheer rock-face skyscrapered up behind him, the side of a mountain. Ahead of him was a sheer drop, cliffs going down. He walked to the cliff edge and warily looked over. He saw some white things, and he thought they were sheep, until he realized that they were clouds. Large, white, fluffy clouds, a very long way below him. And then, beneath the clouds, there was nothing. He could see the blue sky, and it seemed as if he kept looking, he could see the blackness of space, and beyond that, nothing but the chill twinkling of stars. He took a step back from the cliff edge. Then he turned and walked back towards the mountains, which rose up and up, so high that he could not see the tops of them, so high that he found himself convinced that they were falling on him, that they would tumble down and bury him forever. He forced himself to look down again, to keep his eyes on the ground, and in so doing, he noticed holes in the rock face, near ground level, which looked like entrances to natural caves. The place between the mountainside and the cliffs on which he was standing was, he guessed, less than a quarter of a mile wide, a boulder-strewn sandy path dotted with patches of greenery and with, here and there, a dusty brown tree. The path seemed to follow the mountainside until it faded into a distant haze. "Someone is watching me," thought Fat Charlie. "Hello?" he called, lifting his head back. "Hello? Is anybody there?" The man who stepped out of the nearest cave mouth was much darker of skin than Fat Charlie, darker even than Spider. But his long hair was a tawny yellow, and it framed his face like a mane.
He wore a ragged yellow lion skin around his waist with a lion's tail hanging down from it behind, and the tail swished a fly from his shoulders. The man blinked his golden eyes.
"Who are you?" he rumbled. "And on whose authority do you walk in this place?"
"I'm Fat Charlie Nancy," said Fat Charlie. "And Nancy the Spider was my father." The massive head nodded.
"And why do you come here, compare Nancy's child?"
They were alone on the rocks, as far as Fat Charlie knew. Yet it felt as if there were many people listening, many voices saying nothing, many ears twitching. Fat Charlie spoke loudly, so that anyone listening could hear. "My brother, he is ruining my life. I don't have the power to make him leave."
"So you seek our help?"
asked the lion. "Yes."
"And this brother, he is like you, of Anansi's blood?"
"He's not like me at all," said Fat Charlie. "He's one of you people." A fluid golden movement. The man-lion bounded down lightly, lazily from the cave mouth, over the grey rocks, covering 50 yards in moments. Now he stood beside Fat Charlie, his tail swished impatiently. His arms folded, he looked down at Fat Charlie and said,
"Why do you not deal with this matter yourself?"
Fat Charlie's mouth had dried. His throat felt extremely dusty. The creature facing him, taller than any man, did not smell like a man. The tips of his canine teeth rested on his lower lips.
"Can't,"
squeaked Fat Charlie. From the mouth of the next cave along, an immense man leaned out. His skin was a brownish-gray, and he had rumpled, wrinkled skin and round, round legs.
"If you and your brother quarrel," he said, "then you must ask your father to judge between you. Submit to the will of the head of the family. That is the law."
He threw his head back and made a noise in the back of his nose and in his throat, a powerful trumpeting noise, and Fat Charlie knew he was looking at Elephant. Fat Charlie swallowed. "My father is dead," he said, and now his voice was clear again, cleaner and louder than he expected. It echoed from the cliff wall, bounced back at him from 100 cave mouths, 100 jutting outcrops of rock. "Dead, dead, 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 dead," said the echo. "That's why I came here." Lion said,
"I have no love for Anansi the Spider. Once, long ago, he tied me to a log and had a donkey drag me through the dust to the seat of Mau, who made all things." He growled at the memory, and Fat Charlie wanted to be somewhere else. "Walk on," said Lion. "There may be someone here who will help you, but it is not I."
Elephant said,
"Nor I. Your father tricked me and ate my belly fat. He told me he was making me some shoes to wear, and he cooked me, and he laughed as he filled his stomach. I do not forget."
Fat Charlie walked on.
In the next cave mouth along stood a man wearing a natty green suit and a sharp hat with a snakeskin band around it. He wore snakeskin boots and a snakeskin belt. He hissed as Fat Charlie came past.
"Walk on, Anansi's boy," Snake said, his voice a dry rattle. "Your whole damn family nothing but trouble. I ain't getting mixed up in your messes."
The woman in the next cave mouth was very beautiful, and her eyes were black oil drops, and her whiskers were snowy white against her skin. She had 2 rows of breasts down her chest.
"I knew your father," she said, "long time back. Hoo-wee!"
She shook her head in memory, and Fat Charlie felt like he had just read a private letter. She blew Fat Charlie a kiss, but shook her head when he made to approach closer. He walked on. A dead tree stuck up from the ground before him like an assemblage of old grey bones. The shadows were getting longer now. As the sun was slowly descending in the endless sky, past where the cliffs dragged down into the end of the world, the eye of the sun was a monstrous golden-orange ball, and all the little white clouds beneath it were burnished with gold and with purple. "The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold," thought Fat Charlie, the line of the poem surfacing from some long-forgotten English lesson, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold. He tried to remember what a cohort was, and failed. Probably, he decided, it was some kind of chariot. Something moved, close to his elbow, and he realized that what he had thought was a brown rock beneath the dead tree was a man, sandy-colored, his back spotted like a leopard's. His hair was very long and very black, and when he smiled his teeth were a big cat's teeth. He only smiled briefly, and it was a smile without warmth or humor or friendship in it. He said,
"I am Tiger.
Your father, he injured me in 100 ways, and he insulted me in 1,000 ways. Tiger does not forget.
I'm sorry, said Fat Charlie.
I'll walk along with you, said Tiger, for a short while. You say that Anansi is dead.
Yes.
Well. He played me for a fool so many times. Once everything was mine, the stories, the stars, everything. He stole it all away from me. Maybe now he is dead, people will stop telling those damn stories of his, laughing at me.
I'm sure they will, said Fat Charlie. I've never laughed at you.
Eyes the color of polished emeralds flashed in the man's face.
Blood is blood, was all he said. Anansi's bloodline is Anansi.
I am not my father, said Fat Charlie. Tiger bared his teeth. They were very sharp.
You don't go around making people laugh at things, explained Tiger. It's a big, serious world out there. Nothing to laugh about. Not ever. You must teach the children to fear. Teach them to tremble. Teach them to be cruel. Teach them to be the danger in the dark. Hide in the shadows, then pounce, or spring, or leap, or drop, and always kill. You know what the true meaning of life is?
Said Fat Charlie, is it love one another?
The meaning of life is the hot blood of your prey on your tongue, the meat that rends beneath your teeth, the corpse of your enemy left in the sun for the carrion eaters to finish. That is what life is. I am Tiger, and I am stronger than Anansi ever was. Bigger, more dangerous, more powerful, crueler, wiser. Fat Charlie did not want to be in that place, talking to Tiger. It was not that Tiger was mad. It was that he was so earnest in his convictions, and that all his convictions were uniformly unpleasant. Also, he reminded Fat Charlie of someone, and while he could not have told you who, he knew it was someone he disliked.
"Will you help me get rid of my brother?"
Tiger coughed as if he had a feather or perhaps a whole blackbird stuck in his throat.
"Would you like me to get you some water?"
asked Fat Charlie. Tiger eyed Fat Charlie with suspicion. "Last time Anansi offered me water, I wound up trying to eat the moon out of a pond and I drowned. I was just trying to help."
"That was what he said."
Tiger leaned into Fat Charlie, stared him in the eye. Close up, he did not look even faintly human. His nose was too flat. His eyes were positioned differently, and he smelled like a cage at the zoo. His voice was a rumbling growl.
"This is how you help me, Anansi's child. You and all your blood. You keep well away from me. Understand? If you want to keep the meat on those bones."
He licked his lips then, with a tongue the red of fresh-killed flesh, and longer than any human tongue had ever been. Fat Charlie backed away, certain that if he turned, if he ran, he would feel Tiger's teeth in his neck. There was nothing remotely human about the creature now. It was the size of a real tiger. It was every big cat that had turned man-eater, every tiger that had broken a human's neck like a house cat dispatching a mouse. So he stared at Tiger as he edged backwards, and soon enough, the creature padded back to its dead tree and stretched out on the rocks and vanished into the patchy shadows, only the impatient swish of its tail betraying its position.
"Don't you worry yourself about him," said a woman from a cave mouth. "Come here."
Fat Charlie could not decide if she was attractive or monstrously ugly. He walked towards her.
"He come on all high and so mighty, but he's scared of his own shadow. And he's scared of your daddy's shadow. He got no strength in his jaws."
There was something dog-like about her face. No, not dog-like.
"Now, me," she continued as he reached her, "me, I crush the bone. That's where the good stuff is hid. That's where the sweetest meats are hid. And nobody knows it but me.
I'm looking for someone to help me to get rid of my brother."
The woman threw back her head and laughed, a wild bray of a laugh, loud, long, and insane. And Fat Charlie knew her then.
"You won't find anyone here to help you," she said. "They all suffered when they went up against your father. Tiger hates you and your kind more than anyone has ever hated anything. But even he won't do anything while your father's out there in the world. Listen, walk this path. You ask me, and I got a stone of prophecy behind my eye. You won't find nobody to help you till you find an empty cave. Go in. Talk to whoever you find there. Understand me?"
"I think I do."
She laughed. It was not a good laugh.
"You want to stop with me for a while first? I'm an education. You know what they say? Nothing leaner, meaner, or obscener than a hyena."
Fat Charlie shook his head and kept walking, past the caves that lined the rocky walls at the end of the world. As he passed the darkness of each cave, he would glance inside. There were people of all shapes and all sizes, tiny people and tall people, men and women, and as he passed, and as they moved in and out of the shadows, he would see flanks or scales, horns or claws. Sometimes he scared them as he passed, and they would retreat into the back of the cave. Others would come forward, stare aggressively or curiously. Something tumbled through the air from the rocks above a cave mouth and landed beside Fat Charlie.
"Hello," it said breathlessly.
"Hello," said Fat Charlie. The new one was excitable and hairy. Its arms and legs seemed all wrong. Fat Charlie tried to place it. The other animal people were animals, yes, and people too. And there was nothing strange or contradictory about this. The animalness and the humanness combined like the stripes on a zebra to make something other. This one, however, seemed both human and almost human, and the oddness of it made Fat Charlie's teeth hurt. Then he got it. "Monkey," he said. "You're monkey."
"Got a peach?" said Monkey. "Got a mango? Got a fig?"
"'Fraid not," said Fat Charlie.
"Give me something to eat," said Monkey. "I'll be your friend."
Mrs. Dunwiddie had warned him about this. Give nothing away, he thought. Make no promises. "I'm not giving you anything, I'm afraid."
"Who are you?" asked Monkey. "What are you? You seem like half a thing. Are you from here or from there?"
"Anansi was my father," said Fat Charlie. "I'm looking for someone to help me deal with my brother, to make him go away."
"Might get Anansi mad," said Monkey. "Very bad idea, that. Get Anansi mad, you never in any more stories."
"Anansi's dead," said Fat Charlie.
"Dead there," said Monkey. "Maybe, but dead here, that's another stump of grubs entirely."
"You mean, it could be here?" Fat Charlie looked up at the mountainside more warily. The idea that he might, in one of the cave mouths, find his father creaking back and forwards in a rocking chair, fedora, hat pushed back on his head, sipping from a can of brown ale and stifling a yawn with his lemon-yellow gloves, was troubling indeed.
"Who? What?"
"Do you think he's here?"
"Who?"
"My father."
"Your father?"
"Anansi." Monkey leapt to the top of a rock in terror. Then he pressed himself against the rock, his gaze flicking from side to side as if keeping an eye out for sudden tornadoes.
"Anansi? He's here?"
"I was asking you that," said Fat Charlie. Monkey swung suddenly, so he was hanging upside down from his feet, his upside-down face staring straight into Fat Charlie's.
"I go back to the world sometimes," he said. "They say, 'Monkey, wise monkey, come, come, eat the peaches we have for you, and the nuts, and the grubs, and the figs.'"
"Is my father here?" asked Fat Charlie patiently.
"He doesn't have a cave," said Monkey. "I would know if he had a cave, I think. Maybe he had a cave and I forgot. If you gave me a peach, I would remember better."
"I don't have anything on me," said Fat Charlie.
"No peaches?"
"Nothing, I'm afraid." Monkey swung himself up to the top of his rock, and he was gone. Fat Charlie continued along the rocky path. The sun had sunk until it was level with the path, and it burned a deep orange. It shone its old light straight into the caves, and showed each cave to be inhabited. That must be rhinoceros, grey of skin, staring out short-sightedly. There, the colour of a rotten log in shallow water, was crocodile, his eyes as black as glass. There was a rattle behind him, of stone scuttering against stone, and Fat Charlie turned with a jerk. Monkey stared up at him, his knuckles brushing the path. "I really haven't got any fruit," said Fat Charlie, "or I'd give you some." Monkey said,
"Felt sorry for you. Maybe you should go home. This is a bad, 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 bad idea, yes?"
"No," said Fat Charlie.
"Ah," said Monkey. "Right, right, 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 right."
He stopped moving. Then a sudden burst of loping speed, and he bounded past Fat Charlie and stopped in front of a cave some little distance away.
"Not to go in there," he called. "Bad place." He pointed to the cave opening.
"Why not?" asked Fat Charlie. "Who's in there?"
"Nobody's in there," said Monkey triumphantly. "So it's not the one you want, is it?"
"Yes," said Fat Charlie, "it is." Monkey chittered and bounced, but Fat Charlie walked past him and clambered up the rocks until he reached the mouth of the empty cave, as the crimson sun fell below the cliffs at the end of the world. Walking the path along the edge of the mountains at the beginning of the world — it's only the mountains at the end of the world if you're coming from the other direction — reality seemed strange and strained. These mountains and their caves are made from the stuff of the oldest stories. This was long before human people, of course. Whatever made you imagine that people were the first things to tell stories? And stepping off the path, into the cave, Fat Charlie felt as if he were walking into someone else's reality entirely. The cave was deep, His floor was splashed white with bird droppings. There were feathers on the cave floor, too, and here and there, like a desiccated and abandoned feather duster, was the corpse of a bird, flattened and dried. At the back of the cave, nothing but darkness. Fat Charlie called, "Hello?" And the echo of his voice came back to him from the interior of the cave. "Hello? Hello? Hello? Hello?" He kept walking. Now the darkness in the cave seemed almost palpable, as if something thin and dark had been laid over his eyes. He walked slowly, a step at a time, his arms outstretched. Something moved. "Hello?" His eyes were learning to use what little light there was, and he could make something out. "It's nothing. Rags and feathers, that's all." Another step and the wind stirred the feathers and flapped the rags on the floor of the cave. Something fluttered about him, fluttered through him, beating the air with the clatter of a pigeon's wings. Swirling. Dust stung his eyes and his face, and he blinked in the cold wind and took a step back as it rose up before him, a storm of dust and rags and feathers. Then the wind was gone, and where the feathers had been blowing was a human figure, which reached out a hand and beckoned to Fat Charlie. He would have stepped back, but it reached out and took him by the sleeve. Its touch was light and dry, and it pulled him toward it. He took one step forward into the cave, and was standing in the open air on a treeless, copper-coloured plain beneath a sky the colour of sour milk. Different creatures have different eyes. Human eyes, unlike, say, a cat's eyes or an octopus's, are only made to see one version of reality at a time. Fat Charlie saw one thing with his eyes, and he saw something else with his mind. And in the gulf between the two things, madness waited. He could feel a wild panic welling up inside him, and he took a deep breath and held it in while his heart thudded against his ribcage. He forced himself to believe his eyes, not his mind. So, while he knew that he was seeing a bird, mad-eyed, ragged-feathered, bigger than an eagle, taller than an ostrich, its beak the cruel, tearing weapon of a raptor, its feathers the colour of slate overlaid with an oil-slick sheen, making a dark rainbow of purples and greens, he really only knew that for an instant, somewhere in the very back of his mind. What he saw with his eyes was a woman with raven-black hair, standing where the idea of a bird had been. She was neither young nor old, and she stared at him with a face that might have been carved from obsidian in ancient times when the world was young. She watched him and she did not move. Clouds roiled across the sour milk sky. "I'm Charlie," said Fat Charlie. "Charlie Nancy. Some people, well, most people, call me Fat Charlie. You can too, if you like." No response. "And Nancy was my father." Still nothing. Not a quiver. Not a breath. "I want you to help me make my brother go away." She tilted her head at this, enough to show that she was listening, enough to show that she was alive. "I can't do it on my own. He's got magic powers and stuff. I spoke to a spider, and the next thing you know, my brother turns up. Now I can't make him go away." Her voice, when she spoke, was as rough and as deep as a crow's. "What do you wish me to do about it?" "Help me?" he suggested. She appeared to be thinking. Later, Fat Charlie tried and failed to remember what she'd been wearing. Sometimes he thought it must have been a cloak of feathers. At other times he believed it must have been rags of some kind, or perhaps a tattered raincoat, of the kind she wore when he saw her in the park, later, when it had all started to go bad. She was not naked, though. Of that he was nearly certain. He would have remembered if she had been naked, wouldn't he? "Help you?" she echoed. "Help me get rid of him." She nodded.
"You wish me to help you get rid of Anansi's bloodline?"
"I just want you to go away and leave me alone. I don't want you to hurt him or anything."
"Then promise me Anansi's bloodline for my own."
Fat Charlie stood on the vast coppery plain, which was somehow, he knew, inside the cave in the mountains at the end of the world, and was, in its turn, in some sense, inside Mrs. Dunwoody's violet-scented front room, and he tried to make sense of what she was asking for. "I can't give things away, and I can't make promises."
"You want him to go," she said. "Say it. My time is precious."
She folded her arms, stared at him with mad eyes.
I am not scared of Anansi."
He remembered Mrs. Dunwoody's voice. Said Fat Charlie, "I mustn't make promises, and I have to ask for something of equal value. I mean, it has to be a trade." The bird woman looked displeased, but she nodded.
"Then I shall give you something of equal value in trade. I give my word."
She put her hand over his hand, as if she was giving him something, then squeezed his hand closed.
"Now say it."
"I give you Anansi's bloodline," Fat Charlie said.
"It is good,"
said a voice, and at that she went, quite literally, to pieces. Where a woman had been standing, there was now a flock of birds, which were flying as if startled by a gunshot, all in different directions. Now the sky filled with birds, more birds than Fat Charlie had ever imagined, brown birds and black, wheeling and crossing and flowing like a cloud of black smoke, vaster than the mind could hold, like a cloud of midges as big as the world. "You'll make him go away, now," called Fat Charlie, shouting the words into the darkening milky sky. The birds slipped and slid in the sky. Each moved only a fraction, and they kept flying. But suddenly Fat Charlie was staring up at a face in the sky, a face made of swirling birds. It was very big. It said his name in the screams and calls of a thousand, thousand, thousand birds, and lips the size of tower blocks formed the words in the sky. Then the face dissolved into madness and chaos as the birds that made it flew down from that pale sky, flew straight towards him. He covered his face with his hands, trying to protect himself. The pain in his cheek was harsh and sudden. For an instant he believed that one of the birds must have gashed him, torn at his cheek with its beak or talons. Then he saw where he was. "Don't hit me again," he said. "It's all right. You don't have to hit me." On the table the penguins were guttering low. Their heads and shoulders were gone, and now the flames were burning in the shapeless black-and-white blobs that had once been their bellies, their feet in frozen pools of blackish candle-wax. There were three old women staring at him. Miss Knowles threw the contents of a glass of water into his face. "You didn't have to do that either," he said. "I'm here, aren't I?" Mrs. Dunwoody came into the room. She was holding a small brown glass bottle triumphantly.
"Smelling salts," she announced. "I know I got some somewhere. I buy these in, 67, 68. I don't know if they're still any good."
She peered at Fat Charlie, then scowled.
"He wake up. Who did wake him up? He wasn't breathing," said Mrs. Bustamante, "so I gave him a slap." "And I poured water on him," said Miss Knowles, "which helped bring him round the rest of the way."
"I don't need smelling salts," said Fat Charlie. "I'm already wet and in pain." But with elderly hands, Mrs. Dunwoody had removed the cap from the bottle, and she was pushing it under his nose. He breathed in as he moved back, and inhaled a wave of ammonia. His eyes watered, and he felt as if he'd been punched in the nose. Water dripped down his face.
"There," said Mrs. Dunwoody. "Feeling better now?"
"What time is it?" asked Fat Charlie.
"It's almost 5 in the morning,
said Mrs. Higgler. She took a swig of coffee from her gigantic mug.
"We are worried about you. You better tell us what happened."
Fat Charlie tried to remember. It was not that it had evaporated as dreams do, more as if the experience of the last few hours had happened to somebody else, someone who was not him, and he had to contact that person by some hitherto unpracticed form of telepathy. It was all a jumble in his mind, the technicolor ozness of the other place dissolving back into the sepia tones of reality. There were caves. I asked for help. There were lots of animals there, animals who were people. None of them wanted to help. They were all scared of my daddy. Then one of them said she would help me.
"She?"
said Mrs. Bustamante. "Some of them were men, and some of them were women," said Fat Charlie. "This one was a woman."
"Do you know what she was? Crocodile? Hyena? Mouse?"
He shrugged. "I might have remembered before people started hitting me and pouring water on me and putting things in my nose. It drives stuff out of your head." Mrs. Dunwoody said,
"Do you remember what I tell you? Not giving anything away? Only trade?"
"Yes," he said, vaguely proud of himself. "Yes, there was a monkey who wanted me to give him things, and I said no. Look, I think I need a drink." Mrs. Bustamante took a glass of something from the table.
"We thought maybe you need a drink, so we put the sherry through the strainer. There may be a few mixed herbs in there, but nothing big."
His hands were fists in his lap. He opened his right hand to take the glass from the old woman. Then he stopped, and he stared.
"What?"
asked Mrs. Dunwoodie.
"What is it?"
In the palm of his hand, black and crushed out of shape, and wet with sweat, Fat Charlie was holding a feather. He remembered then. He remembered all of it. "It was the Bird Woman," he said. Grey dawn was breaking as Fat Charlie climbed into the passenger seat of Mrs. Higgler's station wagon.
"You sleepy?"
she asked him. "Not really. I just feel weird."
"Where do you want me to take you? My place? Your dad's house? A motel?"
"I don't know." She put the car into gear and lurched out into the road. "Where are we going?" She did not answer. She slurped some coffee from her mega mug. Then she said,
"Maybe what we do tonight is for the best and maybe it ain't. Sometimes family things, they best left for families to fix. You and your brother, you're too similar. I guess that is why you fight."
"I take it this is some obscure West Indian usage of the word similar, which means nothing at all alike."
"Don't you start going all British on me. I know what I'm saying. You and him, you're both cut from the same cloth. I remember your father saying to me, 'Callian, my boys, they're stupider than—' you know, it don't matter what he actually said, but the point is, he said it about both of you."
A thought struck her.
"Hey, when you go to the place where the old gods are, you see your father in that place?"
"I don't think so. I'd remember." She nodded and said nothing as she drove. She parked the car and they got out. It was chilly in the Florida dawn. The Garden of Rest looked like something from a movie. There was a low ground mist which threw everything into soft focus. Mrs. Higgler opened the small gate, and they walked through the cemetery. Where there had been only fresh earth filling his father's grave, now there was turf, and at the head of the grave was a metal plaque with a metal vase built into it, and in the vase a single yellow silk rose.
"Lord, have mercy on the sinner in this grave," said Mrs. Higgler with feeling. "Amen, amen, amen."
They had an audience. The two red-headed cranes, which Fat Charlie had observed on his previous visit, strutted towards them, heads bobbing like two aristocratic prison visitors.
"Shoo!"
said Mrs. Higgler. The birds stared at her, incuriously, and did not leave. One of them ducked its head down into the grass, came up again with a lizard struggling in its beak. A gulp and a shake, and the lizard was a bulge in the bird's neck. The dawn chorus was beginning. Grackles and orioles and mockingbirds were singing in the day in the wilderness beyond the Garden of Rest. "It'll be good to be home again," said Fat Charlie. "With any luck, she'll have made him leave by the time I get there. Then everything will be all right. I can sort everything out with Rosie." A mood of gentle optimism welled up within him. It was going to be a good day. In the old stories, Anansi lives just like you do or I do, in his house. He is greedy, of course, and lustful and tricky and full of lies. And he is good-hearted and lucky, and sometimes even honest. Sometimes he is good, sometimes he is bad. He is never evil. Mostly you are on Anansi's side. This is because Anansi owns all the stories. Mawu gave him the stories, back in the dawn days, took them from Tiger and gave them to Anansi, and he spins the web of them so beautifully. In the stories, Anansi is a spider, but he is also a man. It is not hard to keep two things in your head at the same time. Even a child could do it. Anansi's stories are told by grandmothers and by aunts in the west coast of Africa and across the Caribbean and all over the world. The stories have made it into books for children, big old smiling Anansi playing his merry tricks upon the world. Trouble is, grandmothers and aunts and writers of books for children tend to leave things out. There are stories that aren't appropriate for little children anymore. This is a story you won't find in the nursery tales. I call it Anansi and Bird. Anansi did not like Bird, because when Bird was hungry, she ate many things, and one of the things that Bird ate was spiders. And Bird, she was always hungry. They used to be friends, but they were friends no longer. One day, Anansi was walking, and he saw a hole in the ground, and that gave him an idea. He puts wood in the bottom of the hole, and he makes a fire, and he puts a cook pot in the hole, and drops in roots and herbs. Then he starts running around the pot, running and dancing and calling and shouting, going, "I feel good! I feel so good! Oh boy!
All my aches and pains be gone, and I never felt so good in my whole damn life.
Bird hears the commotion. Bird flies down from the skies to see what all the fuss is about. She goes,
What are you singing about? Why are you carrying on like a madman, Anansi?
Anansi sings,
I had a pain in my neck, but now it's gone. I had a pain in my belly, but not any longer. I had creaks in my joints, but now I'm as supple as a young palm tree. I'm smooth as snake the morning after he sheds his skin. I'm powerful happy, and now I shall be perfect, for I know the secret and nobody else does.
What secret?
Asks Bird.
My secret, says Anansi. Everyone going to give me their favorite things, their most precious things, just to learn my secret. Whoo! Whee! I do feel good!
Bird hops a little closer, and she puts her head on one side. Then she asks,
Can I learn your secret?
Anansi looks at Bird with suspicion on his face, and he moves to stand in front of the pot in the hole, bubbling away.
I don't think so,
Anansi says.
May not be enough to go around. Don't bother yourself about it.
Bird says,
No, Anansi. I know we haven't always been friends, but I'll tell you what. You share your secret with me, and I promise you no bird will never eat no spider again. We'll be friends until the end of time.
Anansi scratches his chin, and he shakes his head.
It's a mighty big secret, he says, making people young and spry and lusty and free from all pain.
Bird, she preens. Bird, she says,
Oh, Anansi, I'm sure you know that I've always found you a particularly handsome figure of a man. Why don't we lie by the side of the road for a little while, and I'm sure I can make you forget all your reservations about telling me your secret.
So they lie by the side of the road, and they get to canoodling and laughing and getting all silly. And once Anansi has had what he wants, Bird says,
No, Anansi, what about your secret?
Anansi says,
Well, I wasn't going to tell anyone, but I'll tell you. It's a herbal bath in this hole in the ground. Watch. I'll drop in these leaves and these roots. Now, anyone who goes into the bath, they're going to live forever, feeling no pain. I had the bath and now I'm as frisky as a young goat, but I don't think I should let anyone else use the bath.
Bird, she looks down at the bubbling water, and quick as anything, she slips down into the pot.
It's awful hot, Anansi, she says.
It's got to be hot for the herbs to do their good things, says Anansi.
Then he takes the lid of the pot and he covers the pot with it. It's a heavy lid, and Anansi, he puts a rock on top of it to weigh it down more.
Bam! 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 Comes the knocking from inside the cook pot. If I let you out now, calls Anansi, all the good work of the bubbling bath will be undone. You just relax in there and feel yourself getting healthier.
But maybe Bird did not hear him or believe him, because the knocking and the pushing kept on coming from inside the pot for a while longer. And then it stopped. That evening, Anansi and his family had the most delicious bird soup with boiled bird. They did not go hungry again for many days. Since that time, birds eat spiders every chance they get, and spiders and birds are never going to be friends. There's another version of this story, where they talk Anansi into the cook pot too. The stories are all Anansi's, but he doesn't always come out ahead.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have
Chapter 8, in which a pot of coffee comes in particularly useful. If anything was making Spider go away, Spider didn't know about it. On the contrary, Spider was having an excellent time being Fat Charlie. He was having such a good time being Fat Charlie, he began to wonder why he hadn't been Fat Charlie before. It was more fun than a barrel full of monkeys. Several years earlier, Spider had actually been tremendously disappointed by a barrel full of monkeys. It had done nothing he had considered particularly entertaining, apart from emit interesting noises, and eventually, once the noises had stopped and the monkeys were no longer doing anything at all, except possibly on an organic level, had needed to be disposed of in the dead of night. The bit of being Fat Charlie that Spider liked best was Rosie. Until now, Spider had regarded women as more or less interchangeable. You didn't give them a real name or an address that would work for longer than a week, of course, or anything more than a disposable mobile number. Women were fun and decorative and terrific accessories, but there would always be more of them, like bowls of goulash coming along a conveyor belt. When you were done with one, you simply picked up the next and spooned in your sour cream. But Rosie was different. He couldn't have told you how she was different. He had tried and failed. Partly, it was how he felt when he was with her. As if, seeing himself in her eyes, he became a wholly better person. That was part of it. Spider liked knowing that Rosie knew where to find him. It made him feel comfortable. He delighted in the pillowy curves of her, the way she meant nothing but good to the world, the way she smiled. There was really nothing at all wrong with Rosie, apart from having to spend time away from her, and, of course, he was beginning to discover, the little matter of Rosie's mother. On this particular evening, while Fat Charlie was in an airport 4,000 miles away in the process of being bumped up to first class, Spider was in Rosie's mother's flat in Wimpole Street, and he was learning about her the hard way. Spider was used to being able to push reality around a little. Just a little, but that was always enough. You just had to show reality who was boss, that was all. Having said that, he had never met anyone who inhabited her own reality quite so firmly as Rosie's mother. "Who's this?" she asked suspiciously as they walked in. "I'm Fat Charlie Nancy," said Spider. "Why is he saying that?" asked Rosie's mother. "Who is he?" "I'm Fat Charlie Nancy, your future son-in-law, and you really like me," said Spider with utter conviction. Rosie's mother swayed and blinked and stared at him. "You may be Fat Charlie," she said uncertainly, "but I don't like you." "Well," said Spider, "you should. I am remarkably likable. Few people have ever been as likable as I am. There is, frankly, no end to my likability. People gather together in public assemblies to discuss how much they like me. I have several awards and a medal from a small country in South America, which pays tribute both to how much I am liked and my general all-round wonderfulness. I don't have it on me, of course. I keep my medals in my sock drawer." Rosie's mother sniffed. She did not know what was going on, but whatever it was, she did not like it. Until now, she felt that she had got the measure of Fat Charlie. She might, she admitted to herself, have mishandled things a little in the beginning. It was quite possible that Rosie would not have attached herself to Fat Charlie with such enthusiasm if, following the first meeting of her mother and Fat Charlie, her mother had not expressed her opinion quite so vociferously. He was a loser, Rosie's mother had said, for she could smell fear like a shark scenting blood across the bay. But she had failed to persuade Rosie to dump him, and now her main strategy involved assuming control of the wedding plans, making Fat Charlie as miserable as possible, and contemplating the national divorce statistics with a certain grim satisfaction. Something different was now happening, and she did not like it. Fat Charlie was no longer a large, vulnerable person. This new, sharp creature confused her. Spider, for his part, was having to work. Most people do not notice other people. Rosie's mother did. She noticed everything. Now she sipped her hot water from a bone china cup. She knew that she had just lost a skirmish, even if she could not have told you how or what the battle was about. So she moved her next assault to higher ground.
"Charles, dear," she said, "tell me about your cousin Daisy. I worry that your family is underrepresented. Would you like her to be given a larger role in the wedding party?"
"Who?"
"Daisy," said Rosie's mother sweetly. "The young lady I met at your house the other morning, wandering around in her scanties. If she was your cousin, of course."
"Mother, if Charlie says she was his cousin, let him talk for himself, Rosie," said her mother, and she took another sip of hot water.
"Right," said Spider. "Daisy," said Spider. He cast his mind back to the night of wine, women, and song. He had brought the prettiest and funniest of the women back to the flat with him, after telling her that it was her idea, and then had needed her help in getting the semi-conscious bulk of Fat Charlie up the stairs. Having already enjoyed the attentions of several of the other women during the course of the evening, he had brought the little funny one back with him, rather as one might set aside an after-dinner mint. But he had found, on getting home and putting a cleaned-up Fat Charlie to bed, that he was no longer hungry. That one. "Sweet little cousin Daisy," he continued without a pause. "I am certain that she would love to be involved in the wedding, should she be in the country. Alas, she's a courier, always travelling. One day she's here, the next she's dropping off a confidential document in Murmansk."
"You don't have her address, or her phone number?"
"We can look for her together, you and I," agreed Spider. "Zooming around the world, she comes, she goes."
"Then,"
said Rosie's mother, much as Alexander the Great might have ordered the sacking and pillaging of a little Persian village.
"The next time she's in the country, you must invite her over. I thought she was such a pretty little thing, and I am sure that Rosie would just love to meet her."
"Yes," said Spider, "I must. I really must." Each person who ever was or is or will be has a song. It isn't a song that anybody else wrote. It has its own melody. It has its own words. Very few people get to sing their own song. Most of us fear that we cannot do it justice with our voices, or that our words are too foolish or too honest or too odd. So people live their songs instead. Take Daisy, for example. Her song, which had been somewhere in the back of her head for most of her life, had a reassuring marching sort of beat, and words that were about protecting the weak, and it had a chorus that began, "Evildoers beware," and was thus much too silly ever to be sung out loud. She would hum it to herself sometimes, though, in the shower, during the soapy bits. And that is, more or less, everything you need to know about Daisy. The rest is details. Daisy's father was born in Hong Kong. Her mother came from Ethiopia, of a family of wealthy carpet exporters. They owned a house in Addis Ababa, and another house and lands outside Nazareth. Daisy's parents met at Cambridge. He was studying computing before that was something that was seen as being a sensible career path, and she was devouring molecular chemistry and international law. They were two young people who were equally studious, naturally shy, and generally ill at ease. They were both homesick, but for very different things. However, they both played chess, and they met on a Wednesday afternoon at the chess club. They were, as novices, encouraged to play together, and during their first game, Daisy's mother beat Daisy's father with ease. Daisy's father was nettled by this, enough that he shyly asked for a rematch on the following Wednesday, and on every successive Wednesday after that, excluding vacations and public holidays, for the next 2 years. Their social interaction increased as their social skills and her spoken English improved. Together, they held hands as part of a human chain and protested the arrival of large trucks loaded with missiles. Together, although as part of a much larger party, they travelled to Barcelona in order to protest the unstoppable flood of international capitalism and to register stern protests at corporate hegemonies. This was also the time they got to experience officially squirted tear gas, and Mr. Day's wrist was sprained as he was being pushed out of the way by the Spanish police. And then, one Wednesday, at the beginning of their third year at Cambridge, Daisy's father beat Daisy's mother at chess. He was made so happy by this, so elated and triumphant that, buoyed and emboldened by his conquest, he proposed marriage, and Daisy's mother, who had been, deep down, afraid that as soon as he won a game he would lose interest in her, said yes, of course. They stayed in England, and remained in academia, and they had one daughter who they called Daisy, because at the time they owned, and to Daisy's later amusement, actually rode, a tandem, a bicycle built for two. They moved from university to university across Britain. He taught computer sciences, while his wife wrote books that nobody wants to read about international corporate hegemonies, and books that they did want to read about chess, its strategies and its history, and thus in a good year she would make more money than he did, which was never very much. Their involvement in politics waned as they grew older, and as they approached middle age, they had become a happy couple, with no interests beyond each other, chess, Daisy, and the reconstruction and debugging of forgotten operating systems. Neither of them understood Daisy, not even a little. They blamed themselves for not having nipped her fascination with the police force in the bud when it first began to manifest, more or less at the same time that she began talking. Daisy would point out police cars in the same excited way that other little girls might point out ponies. Her seventh birthday party was held in fancy dress, to allow her to wear her junior policewoman's costume, and there are still photographs in a box in her parents' attic of her face suffused with the seven-year-old's perfect joy at the sight of her birthday cake, seven candles ringing a flashing blue light. Daisy was a diligent, cheerful, intelligent teenager who made both her parents happy when she went to the University of London to study law and computing. Her father had dreams of her becoming a lecturer in law. Her mother nurtured dreams of her daughter taking silk, perhaps even becoming a judge and then using the law to crush corporate hegemonies whenever they appeared. And then Daisy went and ruined everything by taking the entry exams and joining the police force. The police welcomed her with open arms. On the one hand, there were directives on the need to improve the diversity of the force, while on the other, computer crime and computer-related fraud was on the increase. They needed Daisy. Frankly, they needed a whole string of Daisies.
At this point, 4 years on, it would be fair to say that a career in the police force had failed to live up to Daisy's expectations. It was not, as her parents had warned her repeatedly, that the police force was an institutionally racist and sexist monolith that would crush her individuality into something soul-destroying in uniform, that would make her as much a part of the canteen culture as instant coffee. No. The frustrating part of it was getting other coppers to understand that she was a copper too. She'd come to the conclusion that, for most coppers, police work was something you did to protect Middle England from scary people of the wrong social background, who were probably out to steal their mobile phones. From where Daisy stood, it was about something else. Daisy knew that a kid in his den in Germany could send out a virus that could shut down a hospital, cause more damage than a bomb. Daisy was of the opinion that the real bad guys these days understood FTP sites and high-level encryption and disposable prepaid cell phones. She was not sure that the good guys did. She took a sip of coffee from a plastic cup and made a face. While she had been clicking through screen after screen, her coffee had gone cold. She had gone through all the information that Graham Coates had given her. There was certainly a prima facie case for thinking that something was wrong. If nothing else, there was a cheque for £2,000 that Charles Nancy had apparently written to himself the previous week. Except something did not feel right. She walked down the corridor, knocked on the superintendent's door.
Come.
Camberwell had smoked a pipe at his desk for 30 years, until the building had instituted a no-smoking policy. Now he made do with a lump of plasticine, which he balled and squashed and kneaded and prodded. As a man with a pipe in his mouth, he had been placid, good-natured, and, as far as those beneath him were concerned, the salt of the earth. As a man with a lump of plasticine in his hand, he was uniformly irritable and short-tempered. On a good day, he made it as far as Tetchy.
Yes.
The Graham Coates agency case. I'm not sure about it.
Not sure about it? What on earth is there not to be sure about?
Well, I think maybe I should take myself off the case.
He did not look impressed. He stared at her. Down on the desk, unwatched, his fingers were kneading the blue plasticine into the shape of a meerschaum.
Because?
I've met the suspect socially.
And? You've been on a holiday with him? Your godmother to his kids? What?
No, I met him once. I stayed overnight at his house. So, are you saying you and he did the nasty?
A deep sigh in which world weariness, irritation, and a craving for half an hour's of Condor ready rubbed mingled in equal parts.
No, sir, nothing like that. I just slept there.
And that's your total involvement with him?
Yes, sir.
He crushed the plasticine pipe back into a shapeless blob.
You realize you're wasting my time?
Yes, sir. Sorry, sir.
Do whatever you have to do. Don't bother me.
Maeve Livingstone rode the lift up to the fifth floor alone, the slow, jerky journey giving her plenty of time to rehearse in her head what she would say to Graham Coates when she got there. She was carrying a slim brown briefcase which had belonged to Morris, a peculiarly masculine object. She wore a white blouse and a blue denim skirt, and over it a grey coat. She had very long legs, and extremely pale skin, and hair which remained, with only minimal chemical assistance, quite as blonde as it had been when Morris Livingstone had married her 20 years earlier. Maeve had loved Morris very much. When he died, she did not delete him from her cell phone, not even after she had cancelled his service and returned his phone. Her nephew had taken the photo of Morris that was on her phone, and she did not want to lose that. She wished she could phone Morris now, ask his advice. She had told the speakerphone who she was to be buzzed in downstairs, and when she walked into reception, Graham Coates was already waiting for her.
Howdy-do, good lady, he said.
We need to talk privately, Graham, said Maeve.
Now.
Graham Coates smirked. Oddly enough, many of his private fantasies began with Maeve saying something fairly similar, before she went on to utter such statements as, I need you, Graham, right now, and, oh, Graham, I've been such a bad, bad, bad girl who needs to be taught some discipline, and, on rare occasions, Graham, you are too much for one woman, so let me introduce you to my identical naked twin sister, Maeve, too. They went into his office. Maeve, slightly disappointingly, as far as Graham Coates was concerned, said nothing about needing it right here, right now. She did not take off her coat. Instead, she opened her briefcase and took out a sheaf of papers, which he placed upon the desk.
Graham,
At my bank manager's suggestion, I had your figures and statements for the last decade independently audited, from back when Morris was still alive. You can look at them if you like. The numbers don't work. None of them. I thought I'd talk to you about it before I called in the police. In Morris's memory, I felt I owed you that.
You do indeed, agreed Graham Coates, smooth as a snake in a butter churn. Indeed you do.